Hello everyone, this is Paige Hattie with Reliability Connect, and today we are sitting down to speak with James Reyes Picknell, who is an author of several industry books, some of which you may know, Paying Your Way, Reliability-Centered Maintenance Reengineered, Uptime Strategies for Excellence in Maintenance Management. In addition to being an author in the industry, James is also widely regarded as a subject matter expert in ensuring the delivery of value from physical assets. His experience is lengthy and spans a wide range of industries, mostly in the private sector, many in natural resources, all dependent on physical assets for their success. James's career includes things like Navy service, in Canada, petrochemicals, aerospace, shipbuilding, pulp and paper, mining, oil, and the list goes on and on. So James is also a professional engineer. He is a certified management consultant, maintenance management professional, certified asset management assessor. And again, the list goes on. There's not too much that James cannot do. And he is also the 2016 recipient of Canada's prestigious Serio Guy Award for outstanding contributions to the profession. So today we're going to spend a little bit of time speaking with James about reliability improvement initiatives. Why do they fail? What it takes to succeed? I think you're in for a good one, so stay tuned. All right, James, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine, thank you very much.
Excellent. So we're gonna dive right on in here. So to start us off, can you just tell me why reliability improvement initiatives oftentimes will fail?
Well, the main reason for everything failing is people, but beyond that, digging a little deeper, perhaps the main reason is the lack of what I would call corporate support for the initiative. Often, I find reliability initiatives are left in the hands of the maintenance or reliability people, as it is, it's seen as their responsibility. And nobody else really takes any ownership. So as a consequence, the reliability people, although they make their efforts technically, they're not going to get results if the solution requires, for example, a change in operating practices or a change for perhaps in say material support to the equipment if it's been a parts related problem in reliability. Reliability is not a purely a maintenance or a reliability engineering activity, really. It requires good collaboration amongst operations, maintenance, reliability engineers, and of course the designers. If an asset isn't capable of being reliable, you can't make it more reliable without changing the design. If you don't operate it within its limits, it will break. If you don't maintain it properly, it will break. So the failure of these programs is usually not because they're doing the wrong things technically. It's because they're not doing all the things that need to be done to get that achievement of success. And that usually requires collaboration, and that in turn requires at least a level above where the reliability engineer sits on the organizational food chain, so to speak. So that would be my number one reason, is that lack of collaboration amongst various groups.
Sure. So then would you mind diving a little bit more into detail then about what you would say is needed to achieve success?
Well, the main thing, of course, is that collaboration, sort of the opposite of what I just said. But that takes a little bit of, I think, long-term vision on the part of the senior leadership in an organization. And whether it's a multi-site organization or a single small plant, there needs to be a view to the future if you want to improve reliability. Obviously, you want a sustainable high performance from your equipment. It is achievable, but it's not achievable if you just rely on only the one group to achieve it. So there's got to be that vision. The operations people that basically own the equipment when it's operational state, they need to be on board with what they need to do to keep the asset reliable. And of course, the designers who may or may not even be part of the organization, they need to be on board with it. And if they're not part of the organization, it's the finance people that probably throw the most weight around on them. And it's because they need to design an asset that will deliver value over the long term and not just be low cost to give you a high return on investment at the project phase. What you want is a high return on asset over the life cycle. That's very different from high return on investment at the capital spending stage of the project. So the finance people actually can have an awful lot of influence on this. We all know that if you get what you pay for it. If you buy something cheap, it'll probably work for the short term and give you a pretty good payback quickly, but it won't last. And most of our industrial facilities, industrial equipment, we want it to last a long time at that high level of performance, not just for a short period of time. We're not there just to put it in place like a project is. We're also there to run it for a long period of time and maintain it. And if you look around at our industrial and the installed capacity we have in all over North America, for example, a lot of it's quite aged. And we're still keeping it going long after the life cycle cost analyses timeframes would have run out because of the effect of the diminishing value of dollars over time. So we have to think in different terms than just project ROI. So that's it. The finance guys, the operations, engineering, maintenance, and reliability people all need to be working collaboratively to that goal. It's a big corporate goal. It's not just a goal for one department.
Definitely. So then, James, that all being said, if someone were to come up to you on the street and ask, that all sounds great, but where do I start? How do I start with this? What would you tell them?
The first thing to start with is a change of thinking. And to me, that requires education or exposure to better practices and what good looks like, right? I work with a lot of different companies, and what's probably missing in all of them, and they're all after the same thing. They want lower costs, higher reliability, so that they can get higher output at lower cost per unit. But what they need to do is think a little bit differently about reliability. And that takes a bit of education, right? They look at it from the perspective quite often of a plant that's not running well. And they say, well, to achieve reliability, I've got to do better planning, better scheduling. I've got to do RCM. I've got to do root cause analysis. All that stuff takes effort. And none of it produces a single widget coming out the delivery door from the plant. And they're right. If you come at it from that perspective, you're already behind the eight ball when you start. There is an upfront investment in it. Now, if you do it smartly, it can pay for itself. I've seen that happen time and again. But the first thing you got to do is change your thinking, right? It's not cheaper to just let everything run to failure, and it's not more productive to run it until it fails and meet your quota. Those are falsehoods that seem to be very pervasive, I think, in the minds of a lot of people, particularly in the operations side. I think the maintenance people understand it, but they're very bad typically at getting that point across to the operations people. And one of the best allies for it is actually the finance people, because once they get it, they become strong advocates, I find. But you got to get to them and get that message to them. And that's a bit of a challenge. But the first thing, education, understand what it is they're dealing with.
Very true. So, James, I just wanted to ask as well, you've had extensive experience in the reliability and maintenance industry. So what would you say, if you had kind of like a piece of advice or tip or, anything that, you would maybe share with someone that's just starting out in their career, what would you say to someone that's fairly, early on in their reliability journey or just their own career and education themselves? What would you say to them?
I think the number one thing it would be, because I had great success with it, was listen to the people on the shop floor. your mechanics, your electricians, your millwrights, your instrument techs. They see what goes wrong very clearly, yeah. and firsthand. They get to clean up the entrails of the failures that happen. And they often have a tremendous amount of knowledge about what's gone on that is often ignored. When early on in my career, I was actually a ship's engineer in the Navy, and as an engineering graduate, you come in, you do a whole bunch of very intense training, get all your appropriate tickets to become the engineering officer, but you don't really have a lot of experience, and you're very dependent on the people who are in your crew who do have the experience. And then when I left the Navy, I was working with SO Chemicals here in Canada, or Exxon in the US. And likewise, although I had more experience at that point, it still wasn't as much as the tradesmen who I was working closely with. And once they understood what I needed in terms of information to help identify problems in equipment so that we could make changes and make it more reliable, once they understood what I needed, they became great at helping out. And they were very keen to help out too. They had an awful lot of information in their heads. I just had to go out into the shop and talk to them, or walk out into the field as they were pulling something apart, and they'd be pointing things out as they're doing it. Look what they did here, look what they did there. And I learned a huge amount from them. So that would be the first thing. Somebody getting embarking on a reliability career really needs to get humble, maybe is the word, and listen to the guys who have been on the tools for a while. They know a huge amount about what's going on there, and unless you ask them, they won't normally volunteer it. So you become a bit of an advocate, if you will, even for some of what they have to say, because they'll be wondering, like, why do we keep doing this? And they're asking themselves, but they're not asking anybody else. And because of where they are in the organization, they're often just not listened to. Nobody asks. So that would be probably the number one thing. Talk to them.
That's awesome. So, James, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we wrap things up here for today? Open floor, anything and everything.
Anything and everything, yeah. Well, another piece of advice to them is buy my books.
We can do that. Tell us about your books really quickly. I was going to actually ask you about that, because you do have quite a library that you've written there.
There's a few. Well, the first one, actually the very first one, was as a contributing author. I contributed a little piece to a book called Machinery Component Maintenance and Repair by Fred Geithner and Heinz Bloch. That was quite a long time ago that I did that, but that kind of got me started. And then some years later, I worked with professors Andrew Jardine and Albert Tsang at the Hong Kong Polytechnic Institute on a book on reliability-centered maintenance. And that was in the year 2000, I think, when that one got published. It was used only as a textbook internally in Hong Kong. So it was actually written in Chinese, not by me, but they translated it. And then years later, I was working with John Campbell at Coopers & Lybrand. He'd published the first edition of Uptime, Strategies for Excellence in Maintenance Management. He wrote it for operations and maintenance operations and other non-maintenance people, so that they could understand what they should expect from maintenance. And it was a pretty straightforward, easy to read piece of work. Unfortunately, it missed the target audience almost entirely. Maintenance managers bought it instead, and they loved it because it finally told them what they had to do. So they loved it, but they wanted more depth in it. And John and I agreed we'd put together a second edition with more depth. Unfortunately, he got sick. He passed away with cancer before we really got much of anything done on it. Told me to kind of run with the ball before he passed, so I did. So the second edition came out some a few years later, and then third edition just a couple of years ago. And then around the time it came out, I ran into Jesus Safonte at a conference he had organized in Puerto Rico, and we got talking quite extensively about reliability-centered maintenance, and decided to co-author a book on a re-engineering of that methodology. So that's been out now for a couple of years and is doing quite well. And there's training courses, of course, associated with both of those that are available. And then just this year, in fact, last week, we launched another book that I call Paying Your Way. Not well known yet because it's just brand new, but it's basically aimed at that same audience that John Campbell had in mind in his early days, the senior executive, the non-technical person who needs to understand the value that high reliability can deliver to an operation. So that book is focused on the business case, the reasons for getting it right, and a little bit of how to do it, but not in a lot of depth, intentionally. So that's the latest in the list of books, and that's starting to get a little bit of attention. But as I say, it only came out a week ago, so it's pretty new.
That's awesome. Well, if we don't already, we'll definitely get the information for that book, James, and we'd love to list it in the library on the Connect sites as well, and support you there because
terrific.
You're doing great stuff, and we appreciate you taking the time here to talk to us today, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you again in the near future.
Terrific. Well, thank you, Paige. I appreciate the opportunity.